Hope everyone is enjoying a Monday night off from Mets baseball and recharging the baseball batteries. This is Rich Spirago, known as CT Mets Fan on Twitter, and you are listening to the Metsian Podcast. So tonight we have an off-day version of the podcast to get into everything that I wish I could say was right with the Mets, but I think we're going to spend a lot more time talking about everything that has befallen the boys in orange and blue from Flushing. So to help me do that, I have my partners in podcasting affairs with me. At the moment, I have one, and I should have the other in just a second. I think he just joined us. So first, let me go to the great borough of Brooklyn, the Bensonhurst section of Brooklyn, and welcome in Mr. Mike LeConlin. Mike, how are you tonight?
Hello, Rich. I'm chugging along. Hello, Metsville. Keep your chin up.
And so now we have the grand poobah of podcasting operations for the Metsian podcast, Mr. Sam Maxwell. And Sam, whenever I have the hosting chair, I like to ask you, how are you and where are you? Because I never know where you are. So can you answer those two questions, please?
What is going on, guys? I hope the sound is a little bit better than what we were discussing before. But I am, like I always say, I am surrounded by the skyscrapers of Manhattan right now. And I love talking about baseball and the city that made it flourish.
Very good. So, Sam, like I was saying in the opener, you know, there's a lot to talk about. It just seems like there's always a lot to talk about with the Mets. And unfortunately, you know, most of it hasn't been good. And so here's where I'd like to start tonight. I think we have to start with the 800-pound gorilla in the room, and that is with the current plight of the team where they find themselves in the standings as they have 38 games to go. So here's where I'm going with it. Mike, I'll start with you. I'll tell you a quick personal story. On July 30th, I went to the game with my daughter. We were incredibly excited because the Mets were 4.5 games up in first place. We had gotten the news that they had acquired Javi Baez at the trade deadline. We looked at each other and said, get in the car, we're going. This is amazing. And we go to Citi Field. It was a playoff atmosphere. Everything was right in the world. And here we are 24 days later, and the Mets find themselves, are you sitting down, 7 games out of first place after being up 4.5 games on July 30th, just 24 days ago, 25 days ago, whatever it might be. So, Mike, let me start with you. The Mets have fallen off a cliff. Let me ask you your observations of that. How did they get here?
Oh, how did they get here? Rich, you know what? I have to go back to July, and I have to go back to that home-and-home series against Pittsburgh. That's when the free fall began. You know, I thought this 11-game stretch against the Dodgers and the Giants was going to be the Mets' Rubicon. You know, it turns out they never even reached the East River because of their failures. Again, dating back to the 2 Pittsburgh series here and over in Steeltown. They've been faltering ever since. And, you know, in the earlier portions of the season, we knew that they were bobbing up and down in first place because the rest of the division was faltering, you know. And now the Braves have seemed to have turned it around. The Mets are 6-15 in August. Meanwhile, the Braves are 16-3 in August in a winners of 9 in a row. The Mets' destiny is no longer within their control. They need help. They need a lot of help, starting tonight with the Yankees versus the Braves. And, you know, how did we get here? Well, you know, the obvious answer is lack of offense, lack of hitting. We're bottom tier in almost every offensive category. We have one 500 slugger, one legitimate 500 slugger on the team. And even though a lot of players have missed a lot of games, their numbers are still not representative of games played if you protract them out over the course of a full season. So there's a lot of failures. There's a lot of evaluation that needs to take place. But I will still look at the players. But one thing that really sticks in my craw, Rich, and this falls on the acting general manager, when they fired Chili Davis, and he said, it's not the result, it's the process. Well, if you post-snap that date and fast forward to the present time, the process has been an utter failure. So I need this front office situation addressed, revisited this coming offseason, regardless of how the rest of the season unfolds.
Good point. And there's so much we're going to get into tonight about it. But before we get into the next topic, I certainly want to bring Sam in on the current one. So, Sam, you know, it's kind of, I hate to use cliches, I really do, but it's kind of like watching a train wreck. You know, you're watching it, and you're watching it happen, and you can't stop looking. So in your mind, does this shock you at all at how quickly they've fallen from grace, and how did they get here?
Well, I think, unfortunately, the pitching could not withhold the fact that the offense was not able to push through 3 to 4 runs on a general sense. And at the same time, like, look at these games that we've seen against the Giants and the Dodgers. Generally speak, other than the last game where they scored, I think, like 7 or so runs, they've generally been basically one run behind. And that's what happens when you leave as many runners on as the Mets have. And it always seems like, and I was saying this to you earlier, Rich, that when, you know, they have this crazy good opportunity with the bases loaded, no outs, or the bases loaded, runners at second and third, they never shorten their swing. And they're just swinging so long, just trying to get the 3-run home run. And, you know, I'll loop back around to Sandy Alderson, like I was saying the other time. But at the same time, you know, I'm just, you know, beating, well, yet another, I brought up on Twitter earlier in the week, animal metaphors that don't make any sense. Beating a dead horse is another one. So if I go about Sandy Alderson, I'm beating another dead horse. Anyway, without tangenting too much on that regard, it's basically that. It's really comes down to the offense not being able to come through and just get that. And who's to say that Francisco Lindor might have had a better chance of coming through at some point where everybody else has been failing during this stretch? I'm willing to bet on it, but that's a complete hypothetical that could never be discussed. And we'll see what happens, and we'll be discussing a couple of those players. And as you know, regardless of what the strikeouts are with Baez, immediately he showed what – a difference some, you know, intangibles can make. And that was, you know, taking second with that slide, even though there was 2 outs. But he was able to be, you know, we've seen him do it with slides before. And all of a sudden there was a spark. I think, you know, we'll get into the strikeouts. It's something to be concerned about when discussing a longer-term contract. But at the same time, I've been saying it, especially on the Lindor front, they've been sorely missing whatever, even though he wasn't hitting all year, they've been sorely missing everything that he brought to the table. And I hope that it's probably too little too late, because this turnaround of games is even arguably more astronomical than 2007. Obviously, it happened early, and obviously the Mets had a chance to eradicate it. However, it's not looking good. I understand all the pessimists on Twitter and everybody who just doesn't see it happening, and I can understand that. And we'll get into all of those intangibles. But right now, when you think about that turnaround, I've never – it's 11 games in, like, 21 days. That's a pretty crazy turnaround. And lucky for the Mets, it didn't happen at the end of the season, and they could possibly make a charge and go after it.
Well, we'll get into that, too. I mean, I keep saying it, this will be the last time. There's so much to talk about. But I think you guys both brought us to a good place. So here's where I want to go next. So, okay, we figured out how they got here. Let's talk about what is something that maybe they could have done to not get here. And here's what I mean. The trading deadline, okay? There has been a lot of debate on Twitter about whether or not the Mets botched the trading deadline. And Sam, I'm going to ask you first. I'm going to give you the debate and let you weigh in. And you can have a different opinion if you like, but I'll give you the ones I've seen. So the ones I've seen, you know, opinion A is that they went out there and got Javi Baez, which, you know, a great offensive pickup. Yes, he strikes out a lot, but you saw yesterday what he does. The athleticism, the energy, all that stuff. So some people say good trade deadline. They got Javi Baez. And Trevor Williams has not been bad. You know, he's a serviceable pitcher. So they did what they could. It cost them a first-round draft pick. And from what we hear, the price tags on frontline pitchers were quite high, and they may have been wise not to do it. Okay, that's one school of thought. Second school of thought is the more controversial one, that they punted at the trading deadline, that they knew DeGrom, there was something major going on, and goodness knows that's played out, and we'll talk about that later. So you look at all these other teams. Look at what the Braves did. They basically, seemingly, added an entirely new team, and people are saying it didn't cost them any of their extremely top-tier prospects. So was this a bunch of BS we're hearing? You know, that the price tag was as high as we were hearing? Don't know. The other school of thought is that they knew they had pitching issues. They did not address them by going out and aggressively seeking a frontline starting pitcher. So they were in first place. You have a chance. You know, the prize is there. They could have gone for it. They chose not to. Therefore, not only did they punt the trading deadline, they kind of punted the season, saying that, well, you know what? We don't think we're all that good anyway. So we're not going to sacrifice any more prospects. This is not our year. We'll try next year. Where are you, Sam, or do you have a different opinion altogether?
Well, let me ask you something, Rich. Do you think before the Mets got, let's say they bring up Michael Conforto and they make some of those trades that they made, before they get Yoenis Cespedes, are they a better team?
Well, sure. I mean, Cespedes, I think we all know Cespedes is the reason they won it.
Cespedes is the reason they wanted, but even before getting Cespedes, if we're saying that, like, let's say the Mets didn't need to make, and they kind of did in some fashion with Javi Baez, you could even say. So let's say, let's not even compare the two and say that, you know, leading up to getting Yoenis Cespedes, they had a pretty, you know, okay trading deadline. The Mets didn't even necessarily, you know, outside of the Rich Hill, and you can also add in the Trevor Williams part, I don't think they did enough like some of those little pieces of 2015. And this is where, you know, Sandy Alderson just to me is out of touch. And again, he wasn't supposed to be in the operations, and I'll give them the benefit of the doubt on that. But something was awry. And if it's not him, then it's this interim GM who doesn't seem to be doing a good job. I think something could have given, especially on the pitching front, outside of what you did. And you know, hopefully soon we'll have some serious amount of games to see what Javi Baez and Francisco Lindor can do together, which was the entire point all along of bringing Javi Baez in many ways. So I'm somewhere in the middle where – like, I understand some of the moves they made, but again, like, the Javi Baez one, out of necessity in many fashions, plus the comments right before the trading deadline about playing with Lindor. And so that's where you really do say, yes, I do lean. I'm somewhere somewhat more in the middle, leaning what the F.
Okay. Mike, wind your brain back 25 days. That same day went the same with my daughter, and we were all excited. Time, I was drunk with, not literally, I was drunk with optimism. They had gotten by as they were first place. This is great. But do you think in retrospect they could have done something differently and better at the trade deadline?
Perhaps. And like you say, perhaps they knew more than they led on to insofar as the DeGrom situation. Perhaps they could have reinforced their pitching. But we know what kind of asks were around the market, and some of them seemed a little high. I mean, you can only draft away so many first-round draft selections, you know. Brody Van Wagenen traded one. Sandy traded one. The Mets have better lower-level prospects, and they're somewhat shy towards the top. But you look around the league, you know, San Francisco is rebuilt via transactions. Atlanta rebuilt themselves via transactions. The Yankees got themselves out of their doldrums via transactions. You know, we thought for, I guess, a brief moment that the Baez transaction would have been enough when you include them with the players that the Mets already have, you know. But again, I will point, Rich, to players underachieving, particularly offensively. Most, if not all. And, I think I don't begrudge the argument that they could have done more. However, again, I'm a little leery. I didn't want them trading away certain prospects within the organization. I didn't want them trading Francisco Alvarez. I didn't want them trading Bientos or Britt Beatty, you know, and a couple of others. But again, those are low-level prospects. A-season just recently graduated to double-A ball, if anything. So, you know, the Mets were a little shy in that department. The Yankees packaged together a great number of prospects in their acquisition of Rizzo. You know, I think they shipped out four players. Now, we can have varying opinions about those players, but the fact of the matter is they shipped out four players, and that was just one transaction. You know, so I don't believe the Mets were in that position, and their performance right up to the trade deadline perhaps did not warrant going all in, particularly with the question mark surrounding Jacob DeGrom. And at the time, Tawan Walker was starting to struggle as well. So it's a tough call, you know. Now, heading into September, if they have a strong month start to finish, I will feel positive. If they wrap up the season, say, and have a stellar last 10 games of the season, I will be very disappointed and fearful of false hope.
You know, the whole trade deadline thing is an interesting perspective, you know, because as I look back at it, I think maybe they could have done more. You know, you never know what the actual conversation was. I mean, did the Twins want Dom Smith for Berríos? Don't know. That's what we hear. But it didn't look like, you know, the Blue Jays parted with somebody on Dom Smith's level when they got him, right? And then you have the philosophy of Cohen said 3 to 5 years, this team is flawed, everybody pressed the chill button, you know, and it wasn't the right time to spend all the prospect capital. I look at it from the perspective of it was there this year. It was out there for them to take. No, I don't want to see them trade their absolute best prospects. I don't. But I'm wondering if they put in enough effort. Maybe they did. Maybe they just couldn't pull it off. But you don't know what the division is going to look like next year or the year after that. The Braves were flawed. The Braves lost Acuña. The Phillies are a flawed team too. It was out there. It was available. Did they choose? Did they make a conscious choice that this wasn't their year, or were they just unable? We'll never know, Mike and Sam. We'll never truly know unless we had Sandy Alderson and Zach Scott on this call, and they probably wouldn't tell us anyway. To think about where you come down on it. You know, one of our I'll say it, his Twitter, Mets Daddy, he's very big on that they punted at the trade deadline. They knew their flaws. They had an opportunity. They could have addressed those flaws, gone for it while it was out there for the taking. They didn't do it. I don't know. We'll never truly know, but it's an interesting way to look at it. All right, so let's go chronologically for a moment. So we talked about the trading deadline. That was July 30th this year. So let's move to early August. Well, in early August, what happened? Well, have you seen this movie before? The Mets go down to Miami, and they lose 3 out of 4. What a shocker, right? So now they're really slipping. Then they go to Philadelphia the first weekend of August, and they fall out of first place. Okay. They come home. They beat up on the Nationals. I shouldn't even really say that. They survived 3 games against the Nationals. All those were nail-biters, but they won them. You start to feel a little better about yourself, but here's the next thing I want to talk about. The road trip. I will tell you guys, I was so freaking sick of hearing about, oh my God, 13 games against the Dodgers and the Giants. It's like, you know what? These guys are all major league players. Yeah, they're good teams. Okay, fine. Suck it up and go play them and do a respectable job. Well, you know what? Respectable job. So here's where I'm going, Mike. I'll go with you first. They're 2-8 at the moment, which is horrible against those teams, right? Now, the Mets will tell you that they're hanging right in there. They're just one hit away. They could have won all those games except the Sunday night game against the Dodgers. They were basically a hit away from winning those games. And you know that they're so close, they're going to break out. The fans will tell you this is more of the same old crap, and we're frustrated. So, Mike, where I'm going with it is, and I've done some writing around this on Mesmerize, do you believe that what this series showed is the Mets are so close? They're so close to Dodgers and Giants. One hit here, one hit there. They could be right there. Or are you saying, you know what, the proof's in the pudding, you're 2-8 and shut your mouth. Where are you with it?
I kind of lean towards the latter, Rich. No, I don't entertain the thought that they were right there. They were so close. No. These games against the Dodgers and the Giants defined them. They're not good enough. That's my interpretation. If you want to look back on history, and maybe Sam will appreciate this. He likes to bring up 2007 so often. Look back at the team that Omar put together. He put together an offensive juggernaut. The problem was in the pitching. They fell apart like wet toilet paper heading into the 2006 playoffs, but that's another conversation. But he put together an offensive juggernaut. The Wilpons, you know, took over sole ownership of the Mets in 2003. And Omar was a big part of those first 8 years. Sandy Alderson's been here since 2011. And there's so many things that are just eerily similar and familiar about this team with almost any other team that he's put on the field, even in their success. So, you know, I hear the cries in the background of how pony and things still remain. And I will point to Sandy Alderson as the common denominator here. Wilpons are gone. Sandy's here. And he's been here since 2011, effectively, outside of BBW, which makes what we're witnessing right now very, very familiar in their approach, in their process, and their productivity. That's it.
We'll get into that too. So when we start our future-facing portion of the podcast. So, Sam, where are you with this whole thing around the Dodgers and Giants? You know, they're 2-8 against those teams. Do you take the moral victories? I hate to use that term, it drives me nuts. Or do you say to yourself, you're 2-8. You are what your record says you are. Thank you, Bill Parcells. Where are you with all that?
Why don't we say it a different way? They've lost 8 out of 10. The 2 doesn't stand out as much when you say they've lost 8 out of 10. So I think that if – I mean, yes, when you look at all of those games, they are losing them 2-1 in extra innings or losing them 3-2 or 4-3. Like, it was just so frustrating watching some of these Dodger games recently. And that keeps happening. But the fact that it keeps happening, the fact that it's happened so often on this trip is exactly why everybody thought they would get buried, and they have. And only they can, you know, it used to be that we said they, you know, got up for these other teams, for these potential playoff teams. You know, they survived the Padres, you know, so I just think at this point, as we can see, the Mets could have won all these games. So it's within their power to do so.
I'm sorry. I have to chime in. When you're 25-40 on the road, I'm not up for entertaining any such talk.
Well,
guys,
it drives me nuts, you know, and I've ripped the Mets on Mesmerize a few times for it, how, you know, there is no column for moral victories. And the Mets wish there was one, quite frankly, at least that's the way it comes off. You know, you don't get credit for being competitive with the Dodgers and the Giants. So that's a loser's mentality in my mind. Now, granted, Sam, to your point, you could take the logical approach of they were hit away. They were 2 hits away, so they're not at that level. They have to go out and prove the team in the offseason. Okay, and if that's what you learn, if you were schooled in that regard and you take it forward, that's fine. But on the other hand,
Let me interject real quick before you finish your point, Rich, that so were the 1962 Mets. As Greg Prince has pointed out numerous times, the 1962 Mets were a hit away in 50 of the 120 losses. So there you go.
Well, yeah, there you go is right. There you go is right. So, all right. So, let me throw this out to you guys. You just jump in. They have 3 more at the Giants. If they should win 2 of them, and I think they can, I'm not saying they will, I think they can, they end up 4-9, which is still embarrassing to me. This idea that people were saying 5-8 would be great, I don't like that thinking, you know? It's like everybody, these guys are all Major League ball players. They all put their pants on the same way. Saying before a series that you'd be happy with 5-8 in 13 games, oof, oh my God. Am I being crazy, guys? Tell me, or does that land on you the wrong way too?
It lands on me the wrong way, Rich. I don't entertain that. You're either good enough or you're not. You know, I don't like operating in that gray zone.
Sam?
Yeah, I'm not a fan of saying that. It's just try to win every game, and you know, go. I know it's cliche, but that's really the only way to look at it. Because especially in baseball, that's one of the beautiful things that it humbles you because you have to shake off both the loss and the win as fast as possible. Usually less than 24 hours.
Thank you, and do a reset here. You are listening to the Metsian podcast, a nice Mets off day Monday night version. So far we've talked about the Mets fall from grace. We've talked about their performance at the trading deadline and their most recent stretch of 13 games against the NL West leading Dodgers and Giants. So now, folks, guys, the only place we could naturally go would be, where do we go from here? So, okay, a couple things to think about. I'll start with you again, Mike. So for the immediate future, the Mets play 3 with the Giants. at Citi Field, and, you know, we'll see what happens there. Then they have three with the Nationals over the weekend, then four with the Marlins, then five with the Nationals in Washington, odd five-game series, but, you know, COVID and rainouts, and then three more at the Marlins. So what I'm saying is after the Giants, the Mets have, I hate to say it, but they have, I believe it's 13 games against the two bottom teams in the National League East. Now, while that's happening, the Braves play the Yankees, Dodgers, Giants, and Nationals. So the Braves schedule is clearly much harder than the Mets schedule for the next couple of weeks. Mets find themselves seven games out. Mike, to you, can the New York Mets, assuming they get Lindor back, which I don't think is much of an assumption, I think it's basically going to happen, assuming they get Lindor back and the way the schedule is balanced for the next 2 weeks, can the Mets make a dent in the seven games?
Sure, they can. It's been proven before. Perhaps not by this team, maybe by the 73 team, but we've seen it done before in baseball. That's not out of the question. The question is, can they do it? Can they get it done? And the core of this team, Stroman, Baez, Lindor, Alonso, Conforto, Smith, etc., you know, they're all going to have to finally come together as one. You know, we can't have a good performance by one individual for 2 weeks, have that person go cold and have that replaced by another person's good performance. You know, everything needs to come together. And from here on out, they just need to play as hard and win as many games as they possibly can and make those late season games against the Braves and the Phillies matter. That's the goal now. Make those games count. You know, they close out September with the Phillies, and then they close out the season in October against the Braves. Make those three games count. That's the goal now. You know, so a couple of these underachievers, they're going to have to step it up, and they're going to have to start performing to expectations. That's the problem, Rich. They're not performing up to expectations. And that's what's so, you know, annoying about this. And that's why I'm so fearful about late season false hope. So, you know, again, I'll bring up the 73 Mets. They suffered a lot of injuries throughout the whole season. And then finally, late, they all came together and they all rallied together. They all performed well together. And they won that division. It can be done. It can be done. Baseball has taught us that. So just try to win as many games as you can. And you absolutely – look, the Mets, on paper, were better than Miami. We're better than Washington. So they have to go out and win those games. It's their must wins. There's no other way to put it. Will Jacob DeGrom be a factor in those games? That remains to be seen. I know you want to talk about that. But, you know, the Mets, the Braves, and the Phillies were all on our own. You know, they all have to win as many games as they possibly can until we meet again towards the latter part of the season. So let's go Mets. You know, it can be done. The talent's
well, good
there.
Point.
But is the performance going to be there?
Well, good point. And, Sam, before I go to you, I want to make a point that I wanted to make a moment ago, and, Mike, you just reminded me. The Mets are about to see the San Francisco Giants, and the Mets are, in a lot of ways, the antithesis of the San Francisco Giants this year. San Francisco Giants, and I'm not saying this to be derogatory, everybody says this, is a team of overperforming players. A lot of these guys are having years that transcend their career norms, and they – all happen to be having them at the same time. It's freaking miraculous, quite frankly, when you look at it, because you have a guy like Buster Posey at 37 having some of his best numbers in years and years and years. Brandon Crawford at 34 has never had a season like this. Brandon Belt in his early 30s is outperforming his expectations. All these guys, like, it all came together. Well, the Mets, they're all underperforming simultaneously except Alonso and Nimmo. McNeil is a shell of himself. Conforto, yeah, he's been hot in August, and he's one of my favorite Mets, but my God, the guy's performance overall is a career low, you know? And then you have guys, Lindor's epic with his struggles. James McCann, he shouldn't be this bad. So the Mets are kind of the anti-Giants, and that's exactly right, Mike. You said it just perfectly. The can is there. They really have to get to, and I know I'm going to be stricken down for saying this, they have to get to within three games of the Braves by that last weekend. That's what they have to get to. They don't have to cut all seven. It'd be nice to. But if they can make those last three games and put it in their own hands, what more can you ask when you're seven games out? For that right now, let them take their chances down in Atlanta. Yes, I know how it will probably end. But anyway, but in order for them to get there, these guys have to start performing, not overperforming, but performing to what their norms, their means. That's what has to happen. So, Sam, sorry to keep you on hold here, but what are your thoughts on does this Mets team, from what you've seen, have enough to kick it in and make this a real legitimate race going down the stretch, not, as Mike said, like Kuhl's goal?
I mean, are we, like, saying that, like, 2019 was fool's gold?
2019?
Let's do a recent comparison.
Well, I have my thoughts on 2019. In 2019, I don't think it was fool's gold. I think they had dug themselves too deep of a hole early on and couldn't get out of it. I think it was a legitimately good team. That's my thought.
Right, and I guess one of the biggest contrasting things is the fact that this is the first year of new owner, and the Mets were, you know, overachieving in terms of getting through the injuries, and it just seems to have caught up to them, where they can't survive off of Brandon Drury, basically, at this point, since McKinney is now, we're seeing him seven times on the opposition. So, or we have seen him seven times during the stretch. So, you know, I guess it's now that Javi Baez, I'm going to reserve judgment. Now that Javi Baez and Francisco Lindor come back, let's see what that does. Jonathan Villar has just kind of worn out his welcome on me. I think that he's one of the biggest culprits when there's runners on, you know, what I was talking about earlier, not shortening your swing. There's a reason he's batting 230, and there's a reason why he's fallen off a cliff over the last few years. And I think we're starting to see that. Unfortunately, he's not coming through as often. I want these guys, and I don't know whether it's going back to the Chili Davis talk versus Quattlebaum or whatever it is, or what I keep saying about Sandy, but something's got to give here. And that's what I need to see, what happens when you have two infielders back. And we'll go from there. Then I'll really, truly, fully believe. But, of course, I'm not going anywhere. But I've been closer to those pessimists on Twitter than ever before.
Well, it's hard not to be pessimistic because, you know, I'm just looking at some numbers here. The Mets team batting average runners in scoring position is 237, and that's 25th in baseball. So, you know, I was, of course, reading the blogs and Twitter today and seeing various takes. And, you know, some people are saying, well, if you think the Mets are going to go on this miraculous run and get it to a point where they, you know, win a division or at least have meaningful games in Atlanta the last three games of the season, what are you pointing to? Like, what gives you that hope? They're 237 average with runners in scoring position. I mean, give me something to hang on to so I could believe. You know, in marketing, we say you have to give your customer a reason to believe. Well, what's your reason to believe here? So that is one way to look at it. And you know, pessimism, I completely understand because, I mean, could it be Javi Baez? No, he's back. Lindor is back. Okay, he hadn't been good until the very end before he got hurt. So maybe those are your reasons to believe. I don't know. You know, it's a daunting task, and it's an even more daunting task when you look at the whole team is underperforming, and Pete Alonso can't keep carrying them. So, all right. So that's where we are in terms of can the season be salvaged or not. So the next thing I want to go to the point of salvaging the season, Mets were floundering in San Francisco, losing the first two games, both close games, but there are no moral victories as we talked about. So the owner, Mr. Cohen, got a little irritated. he sent out a tweet. I don't have it in front of me, actually, but he basically said it's hard to believe that professional hitters can be this bad, something like that. And what happened the next day? Well, those professional hitters were down 1-0 in the ninth inning. You know, they're being blanked. And they go out there, they tie the game. And then they go ahead in extra innings, and Giants tie it. Then the Mets, you know, score 4, and they go on to win the game. Great. So, Mike, I'm going to start with you on this one. If you could just make a quick comment on, do you think the tweet had anything to do with their rally? But the thing I'd really like you to focus on, and Sam, when I get to you, focus on the same thing, please. That would be, was Steve Cohen out of line doing that? Some people say, you know, he's the boss. He has the right to do anything he wants. He could tweet anything he wants. He was empathizing with the fans, showing that he's a fan. That was my take, actually. Other people say he was putting the blame on the players when his own front office sucks and punted the season, and that was completely inappropriate. So where are you with it? Mike, let's start with you.
Kind of funny. This is year one. I remember when George Steinbrenner took over the Yankees, and he told the press, I'm going to let my baseball people run the organization. You won't hear a peep from me. Well, we know how that turned out. Imagine if he would have had Twitter, you know? But he was Twitter personified. He would call up the media and have them come to his office or meet them, have them meet him outside or whatever, you know? They were at his beck and call. Steve Cohen, he's involved, I'll say that much. He's aware. It's uncommon. It's odd. It seems like he's the only major league owner, you know, behaving in this manner. He's a New Yorker, so, you know, I'll give him that snarkiness about him. I don't begrudge him for that. I just find it odd, Rich. I don't think what he's doing borders on being meddlesome, but and I have this big giant smile on my face right now. I really don't know what to make of it. But criticism is what it is, you know, and it's up to the Mets to answer that criticism with their performance. I don't think one has anything to do with the other, Rich. I don't think the Mets' comeback was inspired by a tweet. The performance on the field is what it is. And he could tweet whatever the hell he wants. I don't think one has to do with the other. That's not what a professional gets paid to do, react to tweets. No, sorry, they get paid to perform. But we're going to see, you know, I'll let the season stand alone. But if he continues, Steve Cohen, that is, continues with the Twitter account next season and the season after that and whatever other social media platforms come our way, I mean, if he's going to be involved this way, it's strange to me, and it's odd to say, especially having experienced George Steinbrenner as a New Yorker.
Well, so Sam, when you go to answer the question about did the tweet inspire them and where are you, was he a fan empathizing or was it way out of line? But I was going to ask you that, and Mike commented on it. Please liken this to Steinbrenner. Steinbrenner used to rip his team all the time. The only difference is he did it in the newspaper because Twitter didn't exist.
Yeah, exactly.
I think, and I don't know. But I have to think that if Twitter existed when Steinbrenner was here, he would have done the same thing. But where are you with the whole thing, Sam?
Well, you know, what's really funny is that he actually responded to a tweet. And first, just to give you the context, Timothy Bullock, Red Dragon 2005, if what Samson says here has a flavor of truth with some of your Mets players, send those guys the F home and give some of your hungry minor leaguers a shot at the show. And he's referring to a CBS Sports Samson, why Steve Cohen's critical tweets won't help the reeling Mets. And he said like 35 minutes ago, maybe Samson isn't considering a third constituency that matters, the fans. And I think that's exactly what you were talking about. And Mike, I guess to answer in terms of how weird it is, I will say this. It is, I mean, you can only imagine, you know, Steinbrenner was much more personal in terms of what he would say in public about his players, right? And here it was, just like you said, Rich, seemingly identifying with the fans. And there, you know, this is 2021. We have, you know, this is his first year owning a baseball team, and it really is a new type of owner. And, you know, it's the old guard might not be tweeting out there. And I'll also point out that Anthony Brecker and Jim Duquette both didn't think it was appropriate and that it should have been in private. And I only thought about that as the old guard as well, and thinking that that was them considering it an old line of thinking. And think about how all the Yankee players, eventually, you know, in the 90s, I think it was a little, there was a little less going on in the papers when the Yankees were winning championships, of course. But, you know, we're talking about the heyday of the 70s and the 80s with Steinbrenner leading up to his suspension for hiring a PI to follow Dave Winfield. So that's where it's like everybody is getting upset about it. I mean, you know, he's absolutely right. There's nothing that he's saying that isn't correct and that wouldn't be news if, you know, Harry Kuzman 2.0 or you, Rich, said it. It wouldn't be news. It would just be in a thread. So that's my take on it. It's here, you know, get used to it. This is a new type of owner.
Well, it is. And you know what he said when he took over, when someone asked him about tweeting, and he said, he quote, "I'm going to keep doing it. I'm going to keep doing it." He kept saying, and he is, you know, he's been off Twitter since that, but you know, and I have to say, I'm going to call bullshit on those writers and national writers who said, you know, who made a big deal about the tweet. There's nothing, it's nothing new. Like I said, the only thing that's different is the platform. It's Twitter versus a newspaper. It's nothing different. Now, whether or not you think the whole concept is wrong is a different issue, but to say that it's like this thing out of the blue, it's not, you know, and it's not new in New York. We all know where it came from with Steinbrenner. So, okay. So we talked about the Cohen tweet. So now a couple more things I want to talk about. You're listening to the Metsian podcast with Sam, Rich, and Mike, and we're having a nice discussion about the New York Mets on this off day and what they need to do going forward. We've hit that part of the show. And let's talk about one particular piece of going forward, and that's Jacob deGrom. So the Mets put him on the 60-day IL as a procedural move, which is a good move. A few days ago, and he's eligible to come off middle of September. I think the day is September 13th. Don't quote me on that. It's close to that. So today it comes out that the Mets are saying as an organization that if DeGrom can pitch in the middle of September, they want him to pitch. Okay. So let me ask you this. What if the Mets are seven games out on September 13th? They're done, right? Should he still pitch even if he wants to, even if he says he feels good and the x-ray and the MRIs are clean and all that? So this was a debate on Baseball Night in New York tonight where they asked the question. Terry Collins said he absolutely should go out there because it's good for him mentally and all of that. Anthony Recker's like, no way in hell should this guy even go near the mound if they're out of it because of what could go wrong. He's had this little thing, that little thing, that little thing. Shut him down, let him get fully healthy for next year if they are out of it. So, Sam, we'll start with you. This concept of DeGrom, if you feel good and your MRI is clean and you come off the IL September 13th, go out there. What do you think of that? And let's assume that the Mets are at best a long shot, maybe essentially eliminated at that point.
Yeah, that's tough. I mean, I think it basically just has to do, you know, it's, you know, saying September 13th, seven games out, you know, it apparently the infamous 2007 keeps coming up on this podcast. But I guess you have to think about it. Some fans would think about it along those lines that you still have a chance. But I think at that point, modern –
thought process would go to shut him down, that it would be pointless, and let's just, you know, soft toss during the offseason, keep a good workout regimen, and rev it up to keep pushing to the Hall of Fame come spring. So I am a championship. So that's what I would do at that point.
Okay. Mike, where are you?
I'm in lockstep with that thing and shut him down. The Mets are playing meaningless games. There's no reason to pitch him. And if they're still in contention, he has to be 100% clean. No inflammation, nothing. But I would lean towards shutting him down. Let us not forget he still has that opt-out in his contract after next season. So, you know, ultimately, the game and business always clash. So I think that might be on somebody's mind.
So I would agree with all of that. If they're in it, and if he's healthy and everything's clean, if he gets a start, I mean, I imagine not only would it be good for Jacob to say he can go out there and he felt good and all that, I mean, it would be a hell of a jolt for the team. And, you know, how glorious would it be if they were right there and he won a game or two down the stretch that made the difference between them, you know, ultimately making the playoffs or not, and then he pitches on the playoffs. I'm getting way ahead of myself. But how amazing would that be? It'd be like the cavalry coming in to save, you know, to save the troops, right? But we'll see how that plays out. I'm with you guys. I don't care if he says he's healthy. My arm is great. You know, Anthony Rekker made a great point. He said that like five times already this season. You know, it was a shoulder, but I'm fine. Then it was the elbow, it was fine. Forearm, yeah, but I'm fine. Well, you know what? What has happened so far that would make you – that he's going to go out there and pitch and be totally fine thereafter? There's no precedent for it this year. So if they're meaningless games, I do support shutting him down. But, you know, Terry Collins was adamant that athletes want to be out there competing, and you can't deny them that opportunity if they're healthy. So we'll see how this plays out. Okay, similarly, Noah Syndergaard, around September 1st, which is only a week away, around September 1st, Noah might be ready to come back, or, you know, he's been facing live hitters, maybe a rehab or two. But here's where I want to go with it, and Sam, I'll start with you. If he does come back, it will be in a relief role. He said he wants to do it. He's fine doing it. An inning or two, sit down for a few days, inning or two. I don't know, you know, and then I heard it was Sal Licata tonight saying that he thinks that Syndergaard's ultimate role will be as a closer in Major League Baseball, not a starter, because if he could pump 101, 102 for an inning, you know, that's his best weapon. So Sam, I'm going to go to you. What do you think about all this? Let's assume Noah's healthy. What do you think about that? Do you think it makes sense to have him work out of the bullpen for the rest of the
year? Yes, I do. And I do think Syndergaard, other than the fact that he can win 1-0 in a complete game shutout, there is that to think about, that Noah does have that in his repertoire. But at the same time, yeah, you could see a very effective closer in Noah Syndergaard. And I do believe that one way or another, wherever the Mets are, and I'll throw this out there. Do the rosters still need to be set? Like, can he be on the playoffs? And I know it's kind of like, sounds funny to even say right now with the turnaround, but does he need to be on the roster by August 31st, like in the past, to be on the playoff roster?
Yes, you have to be on the 40 at that point.
So could he, you need to be on the 40. So meaning that we could see them at least move him to the 40 by then. Or is he already on the 40 right now? He must still be
no,
on
he's
the 6.
60. He's on the IL. So he'd have to be moved to the 40. You have to get somebody off the 40 for him to be eligible.
And, you know, we'll see. I guess if they don't do that, I mean, because you're going to want Noah Syndergaard in the playoffs if the Mets are miraculous enough. So we'll see how that plays out, and my answer is yes. I would see him in I would appreciate seeing him in a relief role. It would be nice to see Noah Syndergaard, you know, as four again. You know, it's been I can't even remember the last time.
last time Noah was on the mound was in September of 19 because he missed the whole 20 season and he hasn't been seen since. So it would be 2 years, which, you know, so I think we've gotten kind of punch drunk with this Tommy John stuff because some guys come back, you know, in 11 months, 12 months. But, you know, it is major surgery. And sometimes you have to ground yourself that it could take these guys 2 years. Look at Wheeler. So, Mike, where are you with the whole Syndergaard thing?
I have no expectations, Rich, and you can't be disappointed with what you do not expect. So anything he can contribute would be great. I mean, if he helps down the stretch and if he helps us win, that'd be dynamite. But, again, no expectations.
Okay. It would be nice to see him, though. I think it would. And, all right, so, guys, here's where I want to go for the last major topic I had in mind for tonight, and that is can't think of a better way to say it. So where do you put the blame? That's what we do as sports fans, right? That's what we do. We blame people. It's natural, especially in New York. So, all right, let's assume the Mets don't make the postseason. There's all this talk that they have to clean house starting at the top, you know, that Sandy Alderson and I'd like you guys to comment on this, all of this, please. Some people are saying the organizational philosophy of, you know, get on base and hit a three-run home run is flawed. It doesn't work. And I will point to the Dodgers series because I hate that kind of baseball personally. I always did. It reminds me of the American League in the early 70s, which I despise. But I think you saw a significant difference, fellas. I really do. Look at the Dodgers. The Dodgers can hit home runs. They hit a freaking ton of home runs. But when the Dodgers have to play situational ball, they play situational ball. They flex when they have to. They were moving guys over by hitting ground balls to second base. Zeal was calling them doubly productive outs. When you have second and third, no outs, you have the ball on the right side. You score a run. Sure, the other team gets an out, but also you get the runner to third, so now you can score another run without the benefit of a hit. So if the Mets don't make the playoffs, Mike, Steve and Sam, when I get to you, do you say, you know what, three-year plan this year, only year one, right? It's part of the plan. Or do you really think there's something wrong in Denmark that has to be addressed? And if so, what in Denmark has to be addressed?
Well, I'm sure that things are, you know, are percolating behind the curtain. I'm sure of that. I'm sure there's a plan in place. I'm sure Mr. Cohen had the vision. This year was a year of transition. He just took over an organization back in November. It became official, and we're not yet at the one-year mark. So, you know, whatever transpired this year, I think we can file it as an isolated situation, perhaps even maybe next year. These are transitory seasons as far as I'm concerned. We have a lot of expiring contracts, so this roster is going to look different to us very soon regardless. So I do think there's a plan in place. Perhaps Mr. Cohen brought Sandy Alderson on board to better facilitate his purchase of the Mets to, you know, put himself in a better light, a more reasonable spender amongst the other owners. I don't buy that. I think after this, he's going to go a little bit more hardcore and start running this organization a lot more in the fashion that perhaps he runs his private organization. You know, he believes in analytics. I think the Mets need to strike a balance with that. I do think that Sandy Alderson's time here is coming to its end. I'm not trying to disparage the man. I just think his time here is done, and this owner needs to revisit this entire front office and how he wants to proceed forward, and that includes Zach Scott. When I hear, again, it's not the results, it's the process, you know, and we've seen where the process has gotten us, that, and when I hear stuff like, the Mets aren't prepared to hit the fastball. That's ponderous to me. That is ponderous to me. I'll bring up another item, Rich. And this is a baseball problem, not necessarily a Mets problem. But, it, you know, it unfolded within the Mets organization. Somebody we know on Twitter, John from Albany, he interviewed Syracuse manager, pitching coach. And one of the questions I desired that he ask was if he was familiar with Dr. Mike Marshall's work post playing career as a doctor in his research in micro tear injuries and things of that nature. And we're talking, you know, he passed away very recently, but his work in that field is modern. And part of the answer to that question was, well, he was before my time. I'm not aware. And the only thing that, or what immediately rushed through my mind, Rich, was baseball, all of baseball, are just throwing away 150 years of collected knowledge, you know, some of which is still applicable, some of which is not. But it seems to me, you know, they're trying to rewrite the entire script. And I see so many situations where it's just not happening, where more and more kids are coming out of the minor leagues and they're so fundamentally unprepared to play this game, and their acumen is at such an all-time low. It's bad. It's a bad situation. And you know, some organizations are better than others. Look, Chaim Bloom left Tampa. Look what Tampa's doing without Chaim Bloom. They're still succeeding. So somebody's doing something right and somebody's doing something wrong. And I think Mr. Cohen needs to go off campus and find somebody who's going to get this done right. And that has nothing, no bearing on Sandy Alderson. It's just time to move on. New ownership, new front office.
Well, a lot of people say that. Other people say it's the players. Other people say it's the players, and that they have to be blamed, not the front office. But other people say it's a flawed philosophy. So, Sam, it sounds like you're very anxious to get in here. So, what is your take?
No, I was just sneezing Theo. That's all. I think that's it. I agree with everything Mike said. I don't really need to add much. That's basically it. Old philosophy. Understand why Sandy was there as a transition partner, and I think just to go to what you said, Rich, about it being so American League. That's where, you know, maybe the DH will be here next year, but that's where it really dies on the vine. Is that they'll do this station to station, and then the pitcher will be there. So anyway, that's basically my take. I blame the front office too, and I think it's time to move on. And I would really appreciate if that off-campus person was Theo, you know, trying to get the trifecta.
Well, I certainly want the front office to reevaluate this team, reevaluate this core. And their underperformance this season warrants that.
Well, I think that, you know, the underperformance, you have to look at it and say to yourself, is it a function of a, in my opinion anyway, of a flawed system? Then you have to look higher and say, you know what, this system, this philosophy doesn't work, that's where it is, then you have to clean house there. If you say, no, the philosophy's fine, it got us to the World Series in 2015, the same guy, right? He rebuilt the team. Actually, you know, and I'm not a fan of Sandy Alderson's, I never have been. But you have to give him credit for one thing. You know, it was a fairly quick rebuild. And he did that, got the team to the World Series in 15. So some could say it's not his philosophy, it's this crop of players that is just not executing. You can go either way, and I'm glad you guys both weighed in on it. So that's the future-facing portion of our podcast. And I think we've rounded the corner a little bit to say that, let me do another reset, that you're listening to the Metsian podcast with Sam, Rich, and Mike. And we've hit the point of our show where we do a bit of a historical deep dive. And this is the 80th episode. So what we'd like to do, we sometimes do uniform numbers, but no Mets ever wore number 80, at least not to my knowledge. So we're going to talk about the 1980 season. And Sam, and there's a reason why Sam's the grand poopah, he pointed this out. that the 1980 season was the season of transition from one ownership to another, and this season is a season of transition from one owner to another. So I know, Mike, I'll start with you and ask you to reflect on the 1980 season, you know, if there are any players or any things about that season that you'd like to talk about. Oh, that's my watch going off. No, your watch. Okay, so if you want to talk to us about the 1980 season, that would be fantastic.
1980, certainly a year of change. You know, ownership was transferred from the Payson estate to Nelson Doubleday and the Wilpons. And, you know, you could see change unfolding right away with the improvements they made to Shea Stadium. The blue fencing, the pennants on the outfield wall, they replaced the seats, you know, things of that nature. But the team on the field, yeah, still problematic. Although Lee Mazzilli, you know, big crowd favorite. I was a fan of Frank Tavares only because I wasn't a fan of Tim Foley, if you could figure that one out. And Joel Youngblood, big fan of his. As far as I'm concerned, he's jersey worthy. So, and Claudel Washington, I thought, was a very interesting acquisition. He was one of my favorite players in the league back then, playing Strat-O-Matic baseball, and I just grew a liking to him. But, yeah, 1980 was still problematic in so far as the wins and losses, but certainly a year of change. And, you know, in 1980 at least, I think Met fans had a sense that, you know, better days are ahead. We survived, actually we were still in them, but we survived the dark years, put that in quotes. Joe Torre was here, but his time would soon come to an end as well. So 1980, you know, very interesting year. The Magic was back. That was their slogan that year. And, you know, for as long as certain players stayed healthy. For instance, John Stearns couldn't stay healthy, and I think that's very unfortunate. But, you know, when Stearns and Mazzilli and Youngblood, when they were on the field together and Steve Henderson was producing, they were a very interesting team. How do you feel about that, Rich?
I agree. It was a fun – I mean, think about where you're coming from. 1977, 8, and 9 – were dreadful, were absolutely dreadful. 1980, this team gets out of the gate, and you know, you kind of knew they weren't that good, really, maybe, but they were playing good ball, they were kind of fun. You know, the marketing team did a nice job. Remember, they hired that guy, I can't remember his name, but he was a world-renowned marketer from the city, and he was marketing the crap out of that team, and it was kind of fun. You know, and it was like, hey, you know, the Mets are fun to be around again, or they're not a joke anymore. And this was kind of a fun ride. And then, you know, it kind of went to crap in like the middle of July or so. But there were some fun aspects. Now, I was a big Doug Flynn guy. I always loved the defense. I was into Joel Youngblood. I was into Stearns. You know, it was a young team coming together. I was a huge Frank Tavares fan. I know you and I have talked about that, Mike. And, yeah, new ownership, you know, you kind of felt good. You know, you didn't feel like, you know, that the promised land was right in front of you, but you felt like there was something good going on. Now, granted, they hit the abyss in 1981, too, and especially 82 and 83, so it was fool's gold to a degree. But it was a fun team. And, again, coming out of where they were it was, you know, it was much more fun at that point because of where they had come from. So, Sam, I think might have predated you a little bit, I say with a smile, but any reflections on the 1980 Mets or thoughts? No, it wouldn't be reflections because you weren't here. But any thoughts?
Well, considering that my dad, I think, hadn't even had the reverse vasectomy, to say that I wasn't even a glimmer in the eye is probably an overstatement. Understatement, excuse me. But anyway, the Magic is back. How can anybody forget that? Even though it was still 5 years off from my birth, I just from Mets lore, of course, I remember that. And I'll defer to you guys on this one, specifically the Steve Henderson game. In the ninth inning, I believe it was a 6-run comeback. If you guys can speak to that specific game, and I will yield the floor. Rich, go ahead first.
All right, well, I'm sorry. Can you restate the question? I was getting my next thought together. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. There was a Steve Henderson game where they were, like,
yes,
down 6-0 in the ninth inning, and he walked it off.
Yes, okay. Thank you for reminding me. That was my favorite game of that season. I remember the day very well. I had gone to a concert during the afternoon at the Yale Bowl. It was the Little River Band and Heart. Now, how about that, right? And so got home. It was like the seventh inning, flipped it on TV. They were getting killed. I'm like, oh, God. And I should have stayed at the concert. I mean, of course, it was over by then. And then they start chipping away. Henderson hits an opposite field. I think it was a 3-run home run to win it. And it was like, wow, the magic was back, you know, and this was in June. I think it was Flag Day, June 14th. And I'm looking at the Mets results from 1980 here, and they were 500. They were game under 500 on August 2nd, which that might not sound like much, but think about the 77, 78, 79 teams. And to be a game within 500, in early August was an achievement, you know, and they really tanked after that. I'm looking at these results. They really went in the crapper after that. But, yeah, Mike, do you remember? I think we all remember the Steve Henderson game. Remember that game?
I do. And I remember that night, you know, that flirted with 500 a game, because Jerry Girard, the sportscaster on Channel 11 here locally in New York, he used to kill the Mets. And that was my go-to channel at night for, you know, updates and highlights and whatnot. And night in, night out, he used to just punish the Mets. And I just remember all his snarkiness over this particular event. And he just on this night, he just went off on Joe Torre, you know, this being the highlight of his career, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. That was fun, and, you know, Pat Zachary, you know, you can keep doing names, but it wasn't a good team. It was a fun team for a while. I think that's my summary. So, Sam, back to you.
No, I mean, that's, you know, I can really only live these in Mets yearbooks, but the magic is back. It is certainly, especially like you guys said, you know, yeah, they tanked after that, but at the same time, something felt different, and I guess, you know, it's a completely different set of expectations for 2 years of first-year owners. And looking at it, you could say similar fashion, the Mets have tanked, and hopefully they don't go into the crapper the same way the 1980 team did. But at the same time, there was a glimmer of hope, and that's all you can ask for. And here, the Mets 2021 season has not been written, and Steve Cohen might still have actual magic that's back in 2021, but that remains to be seen.
Well, I think it shows you, you know, I haven't really given this a lot of pre-thought, but I'm just going to say, thinking about it, that how much the sports world has changed. You know, in 1980, Mike, it was a marketing slogan. The magic is back, you know, and it got people interested. Now I think the fan is just so much more sophisticated. We have so much more to look at, you know, in terms of analytics and, you know, baseball reference and fan graphs and all these things, that if you have a bad team and you give them the slogan, you're going to get ripped for that now, you know, but back then, it buoyed you for a while, right?
Yeah, definitely. You know, let us not forget, we still had to wait for weeklies and monthlies to get stats back in the 80s, et cetera.
No, that's – remember that? I mean, you know, not to get too crazy here on you, Sam, but remember when, Mike, when it was every Sunday, you'd get the Sunday paper and you'd look through and look at all the statistics. You didn't have it every day. I mean, I don't think so.
No,
every
not
Sunday
at all.
You get right. You'd get what Baseball Reference has every minute. Like, in other words, you can go to Fangraphs or Baseball Reference and look at something right away, or the app, the MLB app, and just know right away what's happening. And when, you know, what's this guy, you know, what's this guy's situational thing? You drop a situational down on FanGraphs, and you could do, how does this guy hit with runners on second and third, no outs, and you have it, right? It's just amazing.
See, this is,
and that's why I think, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I was just going to say, this was part of the advantage of being or living in the New York area, having two teams, because it gave you an opportunity to see twice as many players as opposed to a city with one team. You know, and this is before the internet, all that. And if it wasn't for Game of the Week, you had to wait for either This Week in Baseball or the George Michael Sports Machine to see highlights from out of town. You know, so interesting. Interesting era.
It really was, you know, and when I think about it, that you'd have one Saturday afternoon game where you might see two teams that you would never see, you know, like the Cleveland Indians and the White Sox, you know, you would never see those teams again. And then it went from there to, you know, as you push through the 80s, you get ESPN, and okay, so now you can watch highlights every night. Oh, this is so cool. But now you can watch highlights on your phone. You know, if a play happens in a game, I go to the app on my phone, hit videos, and I watch that thing that just happened. You know, it's amazing what's happened since.
Fans have all
right,
the tools,
John,
at their disposal now. I was just going to say, fans have all the tools at their disposal now to make their own assessments, you know?
Well, how about players? They can go watch themselves on the iPad, you know, in between, during the game, and watch. It's amazing. And other players can listen to trash cans being banged. Oh, we don't want to go there. But anyway. all right, guys. It has been fun talking Mets baseball with you. You know, about a little less than six weeks left in the season. Let's hope our Metropolitans have a run in them. 38 games to go. They're going to have to play much better baseball than they've showed us they're capable of, at least not since May. They haven't played at that clip. So it's time for our last word. But before I do that, I'd like my fellow podcasters to have a chance to tell you where they can be found in social media and on the blogosphere. So, Mike, what are you up to these days?
The Brooklyn Trolley blogger.blogspot.com. I've been pumping out a lot of Negro League games, semi-pro games here in Brooklyn, all about Brooklyn, and having fun doing it. Today I put out a game from 1860. The Atlantic Baseball Club of Brooklyn versus the Excelsiors of Brooklyn. And the game got stopped in the sixth inning because of a gambling element and a riotous element that invaded the playing field. So there you go. Get me on Twitter. Get me at BTB_Mike, capital I, capital I. That's my way of doing a Roman numeral two. So check it out. Thank you, Rich. And are we doing final word? Is that what we're doing?
As soon as Mr. Maxwell tells us where he can be found on social media, we're going to do final word.
You can find me for all the Mets chatter at @_SamMaxwell, excuse me, and at Bedford and Sullivan. That supports my Brooklyn Dodgers TV idea. It's just always great talking Mets baseball and sometimes movies, music, you know, it's not just a podcast, but it is a full service Mets Twitter. So big shout out to them.
Awesome. Thank you, Sam. All right. It is time for our last word, fellas. 38 games to go. 6 weeks from today, the regular season will be over. So there's that to think about. And with all that said, Mike, I want to thank you for your great contributions tonight. And what is your last word, sir?
We lose Mike. That mute button.
Sorry, guys. last word, final word. let's go Mets. I just want to say on behalf of Rich and Sam, thank you, everybody, who gives us a listen here at the Metsian Podcast. From the bottom of our hearts, thank you very much. And lastly, I will just say, rest in peace, Rod Gilbert, New York Rangers hockey great. Be well.
Thank you, Mike, and thank you for bringing up Rod Gilbert. It's a name that, you know, I got into hockey a little later in life. He was a very prominent Ranger when I was a little kid, and I wasn't so much into hockey. But I remember he was the guy, and he and Ed Jockerman, of course. So, yes, rest in peace, Rod Gilbert. Sam, what's your last word tonight?
Well, yeah, I'll first touch on – I'm not a big fan of hockey, but I did grow up 12 blocks away from Madison Square Garden. So, you know, my heart goes out to his family and the whole Rangers world. Condolences. And my final word is rest assured – regardless of whatever happens from here on out, it's going to be entertaining. There's always going to be a conversation. Look at us go. Here we are. And I guess the only way for me to end my final word is also with a let's go Mets. Back to you, Rich.
Thank you, Sam. And my last word for tonight would be interested. And I think I say that a lot in this podcast. I'm interested to see how the next 6 weeks play out. What will Lindor and Baez be like together? Will whatever happens tell the Mets they should or should not bring Baez back? Will the Mets make those games in Atlanta meaningful? All those things. So I'm highly interested and frustrated and angry, as the whole fan base is, but I'm interested. So everyone, thank you so much for listening to the Metsian podcast. We had a great time tonight. And if you had some interesting things for you, and you had to put a smile on your face, that's great. That's the whole point. Thank you very much for listening to those who listen live. Thank you for the Twitter interactions during the podcast. And thanks for those who listen on the archive version. So everyone, have yourselves a great night. And Sam, please take us out the way you always do.
Only one way to finish. Let's go Mets. Let's go Mets. Take care, everybody. Good job, Rich. Later, Mike. Thanks, all. Thanks for listening.
Take care, everyone. Good night. Good night.
Good night, Metsville.